Hello and welcome to Planet in Peril. I'm your host, Alice. We're here today to discuss a really sobering new report that looks back at the last 10 years of climate change, from 2015 to 2025. It paints a picture not just of steady warming, but of a dangerous acceleration. And to help us unpack this, I'm joined by our expert panel. Welcome, Carter, Frank, and Maya.
Hi, Alice. It's great to be here. I'm Carter.
Hello, I'm Frank. Good to be on.
And I'm Maya. Thanks for having me.
So let's dive right in. Carter, this report, titled Decade of Consequence, uses some very strong language right from the start. Can you set the scene for us? What makes this last decade so pivotal and alarming?
Well, Alice, the key takeaway is that word you used, acceleration. We're no longer on a gentle, predictable upward slope. The data, and this is coming from the big global bodies like the IPCC and the World Meteorological Organization, shows that every key indicator of the planet's health sped up in the last 10 years. We've essentially pushed the global system into a new, more volatile state.
You know, that really resonates. It feels that way, doesn't it? I mean, just thinking about my own garden, the seasons feel less predictable. The summer heat seems to arrive earlier and hit harder every year. It feels less stable.
That's a great point, Maya. It's moved from an abstract concept to a lived experience for so many. Carter, let's talk about the most direct indicator, temperature. The report says records haven't just been broken, they have been shattered.
Now that's right. The 10-year period from 2015 to 2024 is, without a doubt, the warmest decade since we started keeping records in 1850. And it's not a fluke the rise shaped after foot heat. Every single year within that decade is among the 10 warmest years ever recorded.
Okay, Carter, but we always hear about record-breaking years. Every year seems to be the hottest ever. How is this different? Is it just a continuation of a trend?
It is, but the trend itself is speeding up. And this decade saw something truly significant. The year 2024 became the first full calendar year where the global average temperature went past the 1.5 degrees Celsius threshold from the Paris Agreement. Specifically, it hit about 1.55 degrees above the pre-industrial average.
Wow. 1.5 degrees. We've been talking about that number as a future goal, a line we must not cross. And we're already there, even temporarily? That's unsettling.
But Carter used the word temporarily. So does that mean the Paris Agreement goal is already lost? And you know, 2024 had a strong El Nino event, which is a natural warming cycle. How much of this is just nature doing its thing?
That's an excellent and crucial question, Frank. No, a single year's breach doesn't mean the goal is permanently lost, as that refers to a long-term average, but it serves as a massive warning shot. It shows that the climate system is capable of reaching these dangerous levels now. And while El Niño played a role, it was riding on top of this powerful long-term warming trend. The key isn't just one record year, it's the accelerating rate of warming.
Can you elaborate on that? The accelerating rate?
Of course. Data from NOAA, the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, shows that since 1982, the world has been warming at a rate of 0.2 degrees Celsius per decade. Now, that might not sound like much, but it's more than three times faster than the average rate since 1850. So to answer your question, Frank, this isn't a natural blip. The engine is revving faster and faster.
So let's talk about that engine. What's driving this acceleration? The report links it directly to greenhouse gases in the atmosphere.
Exactly. The physics are very direct. And in the last decade, the concentrations of these gases have soared to levels that are, frankly, unprecedented in human history. The IPCC's latest major report states with high confidence that atmospheric carbon dioxide levels are now higher than at any time in at least 2 million years.
2 million years. I can't even process that number. It feels like we're running a massive, uncontrolled experiment on our only home.
That's a good way to put it, Maya. To give you some concrete numbers, in 2024, the average concentration of carbon dioxide hit 422.7 parts per million. That's a full 50% higher than before the industrial age began. And just like with temperature, the rate of increase is accelerating. In the 1960s, it grew by about 0.8 parts per million per year. In the last 10 years, it's averaged 2.6 parts per million per year. The year 2024 saw the largest single-year jump ever recorded.
So the warming is accelerating, and the concentration of the gas causing the warming is also accelerating. This brings us to the core question, which is addressed in the second section of the report, the science of attribution. Carter, how certain are scientists that this is us?
The scientific community is as certain as it is about the theory of gravity. The IPCC uses the strongest possible language. The report states unequivocally that human influence has warmed the atmosphere, ocean and land. There's no ambiguity left.
Unequivocal. That is a strong word. But what does that mean in practice? I mean, a lot of people hear this and think, okay, but how do they know it's not the sun or volcanoes or some other natural cycle?
It's a fair question. Scientists know because they use incredibly sophisticated climate models. They run simulations of the last 150 years with only natural factors, like solar cycles and volcanic eruptions. And when they do that, the models completely fail to replicate the warming we've actually observed. They just can't get the temperature to rise. It's only when they add in the human-caused greenhouse gas emissions that the models accurately match the real-world temperature record.
Oh, I see. So it's like trying to solve a mystery. You test out all the natural suspects, and none of them can be the culprit. But when you add in the human suspect, the story suddenly makes perfect sense.
That's a perfect analogy. The IPCC even quantifies it. The best estimate is that humans have caused about 1.07 degrees Celsius of warming since the late 1800s. The total observed warming over that same period, about 1.1 degrees Celsius. So we account for basically all of it.
Right. So if it's unequivocally us, what specific human activities are we talking about? When people say we need to cut emissions, what are we actually supposed to be cutting?
The hoses where it's else last. That's a perfect question, Frank. Carter, the report gets right into this. Can you break down the main sources for us?
Absolutely. The picture is actually very clear. The primary driver by a huge margin is the burning of fossil fuels, so that's coal, oil, and natural gas. In 2019, about 79% of all global greenhouse gas emissions came from using fossil fuels across four main areas: energy production for electricity and heat, industry, transportation, and buildings.
So it really isn't just about driving cars. I mean, that's what you always hear. But this is about how we power our homes, how we make things, our entire economic structure.
Precisely. The power sector alone, which generates electricity and heat, is the single biggest contributor. And what's concerning is that even with the amazing growth of renewable energy, the International Energy Agency has pointed out that demand for oil and gas has stayed stubbornly high. We're still investing in new fossil fuel infrastructure and our ecosystems.
And this combination of prolonged heat and severe drought creates a perfect storm for another disaster we see constantly on the news, wildfires.
Exactly. Wildfire seasons have become longer and more intense in many parts of the world. Scientific analysis estimates that human-caused climate change has already doubled the area of forest burned in the western United States in recent decades. And this creates a terrifying feedback loop. These megafires don't just destroy communities, they release enormous amounts of stored carbon back into the atmosphere, which in turn causes more warming, which then leads to more fires.
I live in California, and that feedback loop is something you can feel in your bones. The fear during fire season is palpable, and even if you're not near the flames, the smoke can choke the sky for weeks. It's a constant, unhealthy reminder of what's happening.
Maya, you've taken us right to the next critical point. These disasters are not just statistics. They have a direct and severe impact on our health. The report goes so far as to call climate change the greatest global health threat of the 21st century. Carter?
It is, without a doubt. The impacts are extensive. Let's start with the most direct one, the heat itself. Extreme heat is one of the deadliest weather phenomena. The IPCC confirms with very high confidence that the increase in extreme heat has resulted in human mortality and morbidity in every region of the world.
We hear about vulnerable people being at risk during heat waves, which makes sense. But does it have a broader impact on the general population, on the economy?
A massive one. The Lancet Countdown on Health and Climate Change, which is a major annual report, documented these record-breaking health threats. They estimated that in 2023, 3.4 billion potential labor hours were lost globally just due to people being exposed to extreme heat. That's an increase of 69% compared to the average in the 1990s. So yes, it has huge economic and productivity impacts.
And those are just the direct impacts of the heat itself. What about the less obvious health threats?
They are just as concerning. A warmer world is a more hospitable world for the vectors that carry diseases. Rising temperatures and changing rainfall patterns are expanding the geographic range for diseases like malaria, dengue, West Nile virus, and Lyme disease. We're seeing them appear in places they've never been before.
And it must affect our food and water, the very foundations of our health.
Absolutely. Climate change directly undermines both. The report notes that climate change has slowed the growth of agricultural productivity over the past 50 years. It's a key driver of the global food insecurity that affected, by some estimates, over 750 million people in 2023. At the same time, about half the world's population, that's 4 billion people, now experiences severe water scarcity for at least 1 month of the year, a situation made much worse by melting glaciers and prolonged droughts.
And beyond all the physical ailments, there has to be a psychological toll. The stress of living with this uncertainty, the trauma of surviving a disaster, the anxiety about what the future holds for your children. The report touches on mental health, doesn't it?
It does. This is a growing and critical area of concern. The IPCC has now clearly associated increasing temperatures and the trauma from extreme events with significant challenges to mental health. This includes post-traumatic stress disorder after a disaster, anxiety and depression when people lose their homes or livelihoods, and a broader condition people are calling eco-anxiety, especially among young people, about the future of the planet.
And this idea of a psychological toll, this eco-anxiety, leads to another form of stress, financial. The report makes it clear that the economic consequences of climate change have become impossible to ignore over the last decade. Carter, can you start by outlining the scale of these costs?
The scale is immense, and it's escalating rapidly. The most direct measure we have comes from the global reinsurance industry, the companies that insure the insurance companies. Data from the Swiss Re Institute shows that for 5 consecutive years, from 2020 through 2024, the global insured losses from natural catastrophes have surpassed $100 billion.
Okay, $100 billion is a massive number. But you have to wonder, isn't some of that just due to inflation, or the simple fact that we've built more expensive homes and cities in high-risk areas like coastlines? Are the storms themselves really causing more financial damage, or do we just have more valuable things in their way?
That's a very important point, Frank. And yes, growing asset values in vulnerable areas, what they call exposure, is definitely a part of the story. However, the data clearly shows that the primary driver of the upward trend is the increased frequency and intensity of the severe weather events themselves. For example, in 2024, the total economic losses from natural disasters hit an estimated $318 billion. The insured portion was $137 billion. The rest was uninsured.
So more than half of all the losses were not covered by insurance. What does the report say about that?
It refers to this as the protection gap. And this gap is widening. In 2024, 57% of all global economic losses from these catastrophes were uninsured. This is a huge problem, especially in developing countries where very few people have insurance. For these communities, a single disaster can wipe out years of economic development and trap them in a cycle of poverty and recovery.
And this isn't just an abstract global statistic. I mean, we see it in our own communities. We hear stories of insurance premiums skyrocketing to the point where they are unaffordable. Or worse, insurance companies simply pulling out of entire states like Florida or California because the risk of wildfire or flooding has become too high. This creates this incredible financial stress for families who are just trying to protect their homes.
And it's not just private homes and property. Our shared public infrastructure is also facing enormous risk.
That's right. Our entire modern society, the energy grids, transportation networks, water treatment plants, they were all designed and built for a climate that no longer exists. The sea level rise directly threatens ports and coastal cities. Extreme heat puts an incredible strain on power grids, and intense flooding can destroy roads and bridges. The World Bank has warned that the cost of inaction, particularly in terms of damage to infrastructure, could run into the trillions of dollars.
Trillions in damage. But fixing it would also cost trillions. I mean, upgrading a nation's entire power grid or rebuilding its coastal defenses requires a colossal upfront investment. Where is that money supposed to come from, especially for countries that are already struggling?
It's a major challenge, but the analysis shows that inaction is far more expensive. The World Bank estimates that for every $1 invested in making infrastructure more climate resilient now, we could see a benefit of $4 in avoided damages and disruptions down the road. It's a classic case of an ounce of prevention being worth a pound of cure.
When homes are destroyed, infrastructure fails, and livelihoods are lost, people are inevitably forced to move. The report identifies climate change as a powerful driver of human displacement.
Yes, it acts as a threat multiplier. The number of forcibly displaced people worldwide has nearly doubled in the last 10 years, reaching an estimated 123.2 million by the end of 2024. And while conflict is still a primary driver, the IPCC states with high confidence that climate and weather extremes are increasingly forcing people from their homes on every single continent. In fact, 2024 saw the highest number of new displacements from extreme weather in 16 years.
I understand the numbers, but I think it's tricky to label someone a climate refugee. People move for all sorts of reasons, for better jobs, to escape poverty, for family. How can you really untangle all those factors and say with certainty that someone was displaced, specifically by climate change.
You've hit on the core of the issue. It's rarely a single cause, which is why the term threat multiplier is so accurate. A drought, for example, can kill crops, which leads to economic collapse, which can then lead to resource conflicts, and all of those factors together push people to move. Climate change is the spark that ignites these other pre-existing vulnerabilities. And the report highlights a chilling statistic on this point. Between 2010 and 2020, the death rate from floods, droughts, and storms was 15 times higher in highly vulnerable regions compared to the most secure ones.
And it's not just people who are being displaced and harmed. It's everything else, the entire web of life that supports us.
That's a vital point, Maya. The report draws a direct line between the climate crisis and the broader biodiversity crisis that's happening all around us. Carter?
Yes, the two are deeply intertwined. Climate change is a primary driver of what many scientists now refer to as the Earth's sixth mass extinction. A landmark global assessment from the IPBES warned that an estimated 1 million animal and plant species are now threatened with extinction, many within decades. While land use change is currently the biggest driver, climate change is projected to become as or even more important in the coming decades.
Can you give us a concrete example of this happening right now?
The most potent symbol is the fate of the world's coral reefs. The last decade has been catastrophic for them. The Great Barrier Reef, for instance, has suffered 6 mass coral bleaching events just since 2015. These are caused by prolonged marine heatwaves that literally cook the coral, causing them to expel their symbiotic algae and turn white.
And without the opener?
The increasing frequency of these heatwaves leaves no time for the reefs to recover.
It's so hard to hear that. Losing the coral reefs, it's like imagining a world without the Amazon rainforest. It's a loss so profound you can't even begin to calculate the cost. A world that's just less alive.
And the science is very clear on this. Scientists warn that if global warming exceeds the 1.5 degree target, over 90% of the world's tropical coral reefs could be lost by the middle of this century. It's a devastating blow to marine biodiversity and to the millions of people who depend on those reefs for their food and their livelihoods.
That's for these Kenameng mass braidwood.
But what I'm doing, I love sound malediction.
Len is an incredibly sobering thought, Maya. A world that is simply less alive. We've spent this time detailing an accelerating crisis with devastating impacts on our health, our economy, and the very biodiversity of the planet. It's a stark picture, but the world has not been completely idle. The final section of the report assesses the global response. Carter, the central pillar of international climate policy over the past decade has been the Paris Agreement, adopted back in 2015. For listeners who may not remember the details, can you remind us what it set out to achieve?
Of course. The Paris Agreement was a genuine diplomatic breakthrough. For the first time, it brought all nations, both developed and developing, into a common framework to combat climate change. Sea level rise directly threatens ports and coastal cities. Extreme heat puts an incredible strain on power grids, and intense flooding can destroy roads and bridges. The World Bank has warned that the cost of inaction, particularly in terms of damage to infrastructure, could run into the trillions of dollars.
Trillions in damage, but fixing it would also cost trillions. I mean, upgrading a nation's entire power grid or rebuilding its coastal defenses requires a colossal upfront investment. Where is that money supposed to come from, especially for countries that are already struggling?
It's a major challenge, but the analysis shows that inaction is far more expensive. The World Bank estimates that for every $1 invested in making infrastructure more climate resilient now, we could see a benefit of $4 in avoided damages and disruptions down the road. It's a classic case of an ounce of prevention being worth a pound of cure.
When homes are destroyed, infrastructure fails, and livelihoods are lost, people are inevitably forced to move. The report identifies climate change as a powerful driver of human displacement.
Yes, it acts as a threat multiplier. The number of forcibly displaced people worldwide has nearly doubled in the last 10 years, reaching an estimated 123.2 million by the end of 2024. And while conflict is still a primary driver, the IPCC states with high confidence that climate and weather extremes are increasingly forcing people from their homes on every single continent. In fact, 2024 saw the highest number of new displacements from extreme weather in 16 years.
I understand the numbers, but I think it's tricky to label someone a climate refugee. People move for all sorts of reasons, for better jobs, to escape poverty, for family. How can you really untangle all those factors and say with certainty that someone was displaced, specifically by climate change?
You've hit on the core of the issue. It's rarely a single cause, which is why the term threat multiplier is so accurate. A drought, for example, can kill crops, which leads to economic collapse, which can then lead to resource conflicts, and all of those factors together push people to move. Climate change is the spark that ignites these other pre-existing vulnerabilities, and the report highlights a chilling statistic on this point. Between 2010 and 2020, the death rate from floods, droughts, and storms was 15 times higher in highly vulnerable regions compared to the most secure ones.
And it's not just people who are being displaced and harmed. It's everything else, the entire web of life that supports us.
That's a vital point, Maya. The report draws a direct line between the climate crisis and the broader biodiversity crisis that's happening all around us. Carter?
Yes, the two are deeply intertwined. Climate change is a primary driver of what many scientists now refer to as the Earth's sixth mass extinction. A landmark global assessment from the IPBES warned that an estimated 1 million animal and plant species are now threatened with extinction, many within decades. While land use change is currently the biggest driver, climate change is projected to become as or even more important in the coming decades.
Can you give us a concrete example of this happening right now?
The most potent symbol is the fate of the world's coral reefs. The last decade has been catastrophic for them. The Great Barrier Reef, for instance, has suffered 6 mass coral bleaching events just since 2015.
These are caused by prolonged marine heat waves that literally cook the coral, causing them to expel their symbiotic algae and turn white. The increasing frequency of these heat waves leaves no time for the reefs to recover.
It's so hard to hear that. Losing the coral reefs, it's like imagining a world without the Amazon rainforest. It's a loss so profound you can't even begin to calculate the cost. A world that's just less alive.
And then there's Alanis. And the science is very clear on this. Scientists warn that if global warming exceeds the 1.5 degree target, over 90% of the world's tropical coral reefs could be lost by the middle of this century. It's a devastating blow to marine biodiversity and to the millions of people who depend on those reefs for their food and their livelihoods.
That is an incredibly sobering thought, Maya. A world that is simply less alive.
We've
spent this time detailing an accelerating crisis with devastating impacts on our health, our economy, and the very biodiversity of the planet. It's a stark picture, but the world has not been completely idle. The final section of the report assesses the global response. Carter, the central pillar of international climate policy over the past decade has been the Paris Agreement, adopted back in 2015. For listeners who may not remember the details, can you remind us what it set out to achieve?
Of course. The Paris Agreement was a genuine diplomatic breakthrough. For the first time, it brought all nations, both developed and developing, into a common framework to combat climate change. Its main goals are to hold the increase in the global average temperature to well below 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, and to pursue efforts to limit that temperature increase even further to 1.5 degrees Celsius.
And how is it designed to achieve that? What's the actual mechanism?
The agreement operates on a 5-year cycle of what's called ratcheting ambition. The idea is that countries are required to submit their own national climate action plans, which are known as nationally determined contributions, or NDCs. Then, every 5 years, they are supposed to come back to the table with a new, stronger plan that is more ambitious than their last one.
Okay, hold on. Nationally determined contributions. That sounds like a lot of diplomatic jargon. If I'm hearing you right, does that just mean that every country gets to make up its own plan? And there's no real penalty or enforcement if they don't follow it or if their plan is too weak.
You're not wrong, Frank. It is not an international treaty with a heavy-handed enforcement mechanism in the traditional sense. It's a framework that is built more on transparency, reporting, and a kind of global peer pressure. The idea is that by having everyone's commitments out in the open, and by regularly taking stock of our collective progress, countries will be encouraged and expected to ramp up their efforts over time.
So it's less of a strict global law and more of a collective promise, a set of promises, really. But based on everything we've talked about today, from the shattered temperature records to the accelerating ice melt, it seems like those promises are being broken.
Maya, that takes us directly to what the report calls the ambition gap. Carter, you explained the process. Now let's talk about the reality. How big is the shortfall between what countries have promised in their NDCs and what the science tells us we actually need to do?
The
shortfall is massive. It's a chasm, really. The most recent analysis from the United Nations, which looked at the latest pledges from 195 countries, concluded that we are falling miles short of what's needed. If every country fully implemented its current pledges, we would see a global emission reduction of only about 5.9% by 2030 compared to 2019 levels.
Only 6%? That sounds tiny. How does that compare to the goal?
Well, the IPCC, the main scientific body, has found that to keep the 1.5 degree limit within reach, our emissions need to be slashed by at least 43% by 2030. So we are pledging for a 6% cut when we need a 43% cut. This gap means that the sum of all these national promises currently has the world on a trajectory toward a catastrophic level of warming, somewhere between 2.5 and 2.9 degrees Celsius.
That's just astounding. It's not a gap, it's a total disconnect from reality. So these huge annual conferences, the COPs we hear about on the news every year with all the world leaders, what are they actually achieving if the numbers are still this bad? Is it just a talking shop?
That's a criticism you hear a lot, and there is a great deal of frustration. These conferences are the primary venue for negotiating how to implement the Paris Agreement. They have produced some important outcomes. For instance, COP28 in Dubai produced the first ever global stocktake, which is essentially the world's climate report card, and it ended with a historic first ever call for countries to begin transitioning away from fossil fuels.
The Carter, the language there seems so important. I remember the debate was about a phase out of fossil fuels, but the final agreement was to transition away from them. It feels like very carefully chosen, watered down language. Does that kind of subtle change in wording actually lead to real-world action, or does it just give countries a loophole?
That is the heart of the debate. Many nations were deeply disappointed that the language wasn't stronger. The hope is that even that language signals a clear direction to the global economy. That same conference also established a global goal to triple renewable energy capacity and double the rate of energy efficiency improvements by 2030, which are very concrete targets.
And what about the most recent conference mentioned in the report, COP29?
That was dubbed the Finance COP. Its main job was to agree on a new climate finance goal to help developing nations. After very contentious negotiations, they agreed that developed countries should lead in mobilizing at least $300 billion per year by 2035 for developing nations. But again, many of those nations expressed deep disappointment, stating that this number falls far, far short of their estimated needs, which are in the trillions.
This still seems to be a recurring theme of falling short. Let's shift from the policy to the other major part of the response, which is technology. Here, the report does seem to highlight one area as a significant success story, and that is the renewables revolution.
Yes, this has been the brightest spot of the last decade, without a doubt. We've seen an absolutely explosive growth of renewable energy technologies, especially solar panels and wind power. This was driven by incredible innovation and economies of scale, and it caused the costs of solar and wind to plummet. They are now the cheapest sources of new electricity generation in most of the world. To give you a sense of the scale, in 2023, the world added a record 473 gigawatts of new renewable capacity. The International Energy Agency even forecasts that this year, in 2025, renewables will overtake coal as the single largest source of global electricity.
Things that are helly wastergales. I mean, that's genuinely good news, and everyone loves seeing cheaper energy. But I noticed the report also says that we are still not on track to meet that COP28 goal of tripling renewable capacity by 2030. Why is that? If this technology is so cheap and effective, why aren't we just building it everywhere, all the time, as fast as we possibly can? What's the holdup?
It's a great question, Frank. The momentum is incredible, but the scale of the challenge is even bigger. To achieve that tripling goal, we would need to be adding on average around 1,050 gigawatts of new capacity every single year for the rest of the decade. That's more than double the record we just set in 2023. The barriers are no longer primarily about cost. They are about things like modernizing our electrical grids to handle this new type of energy, overcoming supply chain bottlenecks for components, and streamlining the permitting processes to get projects built faster. So even in this huge success story, there is a major gap between our current progress and the required pace of change.
So Carter, even our biggest technological success story, renewable energy, is facing a challenge of sheer scale and speed. The report points to another critical tool in the toolbox, something often called the first fuel, which is energy efficiency.
Now, this is something that just seems like pure common sense to me. Using less energy to get the same result, whether it's an efficient appliance or an insulated home, it saves people money on their bills, it reduces strain on the power grid, and it cuts emissions. It seems like the absolute lowest hanging fruit. Why aren't we talking about this constantly?
You are absolutely right, Frank. Improving energy efficiency is the cheapest and cleanest way to address our energy needs, which is why the COP28 goal to double the global average annual rate of energy efficiency improvements by 2030 is so critical. But the reality, as the report lays out, has been deeply disappointing.
How so? What does the data show?
After a brief speed up in 2022, which was mostly in response to the global energy crisis, the rate of global energy intensity improvement slowed way down to just 1% in both 2023 and 2024. To be on a pathway to net zero emissions, we need that rate to be averaging around 4% per year. So we are falling far short. The report effectively calls it a major and concerning policy failure on a global scale.
So if we're failing on the common sense goal of efficiency, what about the more high-tech solutions that promise to clean up our existing emissions? Carter, the report spends some time on carbon capture, utilization, and storage, or CCUS.
Again, on the surface, this sounds like a pragmatic solution. For those really difficult industries that are hard to electrify, like making cement or steel, why not just build a system to capture the carbon dioxide before it ever gets into the atmosphere? It seems like a logical way to solve the problem, without having to completely shut down these essential industries overnight.
That is exactly how it is often presented, Frank, as a necessary solution for these hard-to-abate sectors. And there is a lot of momentum in terms of announcements. The report notes there are over 700 projects in various stages of development. However, it also points to a massive gap between those announcements and the operational reality.
What do you mean by that? A gap between announcements and reality?
As of early 2024, the total global operational capacity for capturing CO2 was just over 50 million tons per year. That is a tiny fraction of what has been announced or proposed for 2030. And critically, only 20% of that announced capacity had actually reached a final investment decision. This indicates that most of these projects are still just on the drawing board. They are not yet real. So deployment has consistently and significantly lagged behind the expectations and the promises.
You know, I have to wonder if there's a risk here that this technology just becomes an excuse, a way for fossil fuel companies and heavy industries to continue polluting under the promise that someday in the future they'll be able to clean it all up. It feels like it could be a dangerous distraction from the real work of actually cutting emissions at the source.
Speaking of potentially dangerous and controversial ideas, the report mentions that as the world falls further behind on emissions reductions, there is a growing, albeit highly contentious, interest in something called solar geoengineering. Carter, can you even begin to explain what that is?
I can try. It's also sometimes called solar radiation modification. This refers to a set of hypothetical technologies that are designed to cool the planet by reflecting a small fraction of incoming sunlight back out to space. The most commonly discussed method is called stratospheric aerosol injection, which would involve spraying reflective particles, like sulfur dioxide, into the upper atmosphere to mimic the cooling effect of a large volcanic eruption.
That sounds absolutely terrifying. I mean, the idea of us deliberately conducting a planetary-scale experiment with our only atmosphere, when we can't possibly predict all the consequences, it just feels like the height of human arrogance. We've already made one huge mess by pumping carbon dioxide into the air. This sounds like a way to make another, potentially even worse mess.
Your reaction, Maya, captures the essence of the controversy. The scientific community is extremely cautious. The report emphasizes that geoengineering is not a substitute for cutting emissions. It does not address the root cause of the problem, which is the greenhouse gas blanket, and it carries immense and poorly understood risks. It could potentially disrupt regional weather patterns, harm the ozone layer, and it creates a moral hazard by possibly reducing the incentive for us to do the hard work of decarbonizing our economy.
So it's seen as a last-ditch, break-glass-in-case-of-emergency option with huge potential side effects. Maya, your point about the arrogance of these high-tech ideas is well taken. And while we're discussing these futuristic and risky technologies, the report highlights a profound failure in a much more basic and immediate area: finance and justice for the people already suffering the consequences. Carter, can you explain what the report calls the adaptation finance gap?
This is one of the most sobering findings in the entire report. While much of the focus is on mitigation, which is cutting emissions, adaptation, which is preparing for the impacts of climate change, is equally critical, especially for the world's most vulnerable nations. The UNEP Adaptation Gap Report revealed a staggering shortfall in funding.
And how big is the shortfall?
The report estimates that the annual adaptation finance needs of developing countries are somewhere between $215 billion and $387 billion. In stark contrast, the total international public finance that flowed to these countries for adaptation in 2021 was just $21 billion, which was actually a 15% decline from the year before. This means the actual needs are 10 to 18 times greater than the funds that are actually being provided, leaving the most vulnerable communities dangerously exposed and underprepared.
I understand the need is great, but why is this framed as a justice issue? Isn't every country ultimately responsible for protecting its own citizens and adapting to its own challenges?
That question gets to the very core of the UN climate negotiations. The entire process is built upon a foundational principle known as common but differentiated responsibilities and respective capabilities. It's a bit of a mouthful, but the concept is straightforward.
It acknowledges that while all nations share a common responsibility to protect the global climate, the developed countries, which have been industrializing for over a century, bear a much greater historical responsibility for causing the problem in the first place. they also possess far greater financial and technological capabilities to address it.
And so it's the idea that the polluter should pay. The ones who created the mess have a greater obligation to help clean it up and to help protect those who are most harmed by it.
Exactly. Climate justice frameworks articulate this through the concept of a double inequality. The very people and nations who have contributed the least to the emissions that cause climate change are the ones who are suffering the earliest and most severe consequences. Therefore, a just global response requires that the developed nations lead the way in making the deepest emissions cuts, and that they provide substantial financial and technological support to help developing nations adapt to the impacts they did little to.
Carter, you were just explaining this core principle of climate justice, that the nations with the greatest historical responsibility for emissions also have the greatest capacity to help solve the problem.
Yes, and it builds on what Maya was saying. It's about recognizing the profound unfairness, the double inequality that lies at the heart of the climate crisis. The people who are most harmed are the ones who did the least to cause the problem. Think about it, a farmer in the Sahel whose land is turning to desert, or a family in a low-lying island nation whose home is threatened by sea level rise. Their contribution to historical emissions is practically zero.
So what you're saying is that farmer, whose crops are failing from a drought they had no part in creating, is right now paying a much, much higher price than someone in a wealthy country who has, you know, benefited from a century of industrial development powered by fossil fuels.
That is the injustice in a nutshell. And so the framework for a just response is built on that understanding. It means developed nations have a moral and ethical obligation to lead with deep, rapid emissions cuts. And crucially, it means they have an obligation to provide significant financial and technological support to help developing nations build clean economies and adapt to the impacts they are already facing.
I understand the moral argument, I do. But from a purely practical standpoint, it seems incredibly complicated. I mean, how far back do you go to assign this historical responsibility? Are you trying to calculate the emissions of the United Kingdom from the 1880s? It feels like an impossibly complex way to assign blame.
That's a fair point, Frank, and you know it's less about calculating precise historical blame and more about acknowledging the reality of the present day. The framework is not about punishing past generations. It's about recognizing which nations today have the accumulated wealth, the technology, and the stable institutions, many of which were built on that history of fossil fuel development, to lead the global response. It's about capability and responsibility in the here and now.
This whole conversation about justice, responsibility, and the immense shortfall in support really underscores the urgency of the crisis. And perhaps nothing in this entire report highlights that urgency more than the growing scientific understanding of a concept known as climate tipping points. Carter, for our listeners, what exactly is a tipping point?
It is probably the most sobering concept in all of climate science. The IPCC defines a tipping point as a critical threshold in the Earth's system. Once that threshold is crossed, a part of the system could trigger an abrupt, cascading, and potentially irreversible change.
How's that?
Abrupt and irreversible. Those are two very powerful words. What does irreversible mean in this context?
It means that even if we manage to cool the planet back down later, the system might not flip back. The change could be locked in for centuries or even millennia. We could pass a point of no return.
That is a terrifying thought. So what are these systems? What parts of the planet are we talking about?
Scientists have identified several large-scale components of the Earth's system that may have these tipping points. The most commonly discussed are the Great Ice Sheets. We're talking about the irreversible collapse of the Greenland and the West Antarctic ice sheets.
And what would be the consequence of something like that?
Well, together those two ice sheets hold enough frozen water to raise the global mean sea level by over 10 meters. That's about 33 feet.
10 meters. I can't even comprehend that. That's not just flooding. That is wiping entire cities, entire island nations completely off the map for good.
Yes, the consequences would be civilization altering. And another major tipping element is in the oceans themselves. A major slowdown or even a shutdown of the Atlantic Meridional overturning circulation, often called the AMOC.
The AMOC. I've heard of that, but it sounds like something out of a disaster movie. What does this current actually do for us?
It's a massive system of ocean currents that acts like a conveyor belt, transporting warm water from the tropics up to the North Atlantic. It plays a huge role in regulating weather patterns, especially in the Northern Hemisphere. A collapse of this system would drastically alter weather across North America and Europe, causing, you know, extreme cooling in some places, changing rainfall patterns, and disrupting monsoons that billions of people depend on for their food.
So we have the ice and the oceans. What else?
Then we have the biosphere systems. There are two major ones scientists are deeply concerned about. The first is the potential dieback of the Amazon rainforest.
So the Amazon could go from being this vital carbon sink that helps us to becoming a major carbon source that actually hurts us?
Precisely. Large parts of the forest could transition into a drier savanna-like ecosystem, and in doing so it would release the vast quantities of carbon stored in its trees and soil, which would create a powerful feedback loop that accelerates even more global warming.
And the other one? You hear people talk about a ticking carbon bomb in the Arctic. Is that what you mean?
That's the one. The abrupt widespread thawing of permafrost. This is the permanently frozen ground in the Arctic regions, and it contains enormous amounts of organic carbon that has been locked away for thousands of years. As it thaws, microbes decompose that organic matter and release it into the atmosphere as carbon dioxide and, even more potently, methane. This is another one of those dangerous feedback loops.
So, Carter, we have these massive continent-scale systems that could fundamentally break. I think for a long time, many of us thought of these tipping points as very distant risks. You know, things that might happen if warming got really, really bad, say at 5 or 6 degrees Celsius. What does the latest science in the report say about that?
This, Alice, is perhaps the single most concerning finding to emerge in the last few years of research. The scientific consensus has shifted. Those early estimates that suggested these were high warming risks have been revised. The latest research, which is cited in the IPCC reports, indicates that the temperature thresholds for triggering some of these tipping points may be much, much lower than we previously thought.
How much lower are we talking about?
The latest studies indicate that several of these major tipping points, including the collapse of the Greenland and West Antarctic ice sheets, the shutdown of the AMOC, and widespread permafrost thaw, could potentially be triggered at warming levels between 1.5 and 2.0 degrees Celsius.
But wait a minute, Carter, you said at the very, very beginning of our conversation that the world already temporarily breached 1.5 degrees of warming in 2024. If the trigger point is 1.5 degrees, what does that mean for us right now?
It means that the risk is no longer a distant abstract threat for future generations. It places the possibility of crossing these irreversible thresholds squarely within the realm of possibility this century. It moves the conversation from the future into the immediate present. And you know, it adds a profound, almost existential urgency to the need for immediate, deep, and drastic emissions reductions. The window of opportunity to steer away from these points is closing, and it is closing very, very rapidly.
That's a beautiful part, huh? That is a deeply unsettling reality to confront, Carter. And Maya, I see you reacting to that. When you hear that the 1.5 degree line, which we've talked about for so long as this future guardrail, is not only something we've touched, but is also the potential trigger for these irreversible changes, what does that feel like?
You know, it almost takes your breath away. It feels like we've been driving towards a cliff in the fog, arguing about how fast we should be going. And Carter is saying the fog has just cleared, and we're right at the edge, we're there. That's a very, very hard thing to fully process.
It is, and it brings up a really difficult practical question for me. If we're already on the verge of crossing these irreversible thresholds, what is the point of all this?